The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Miku, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. Most of America and most of us around here are outraged about what's going on with AIG, with bonuses being paid and a lot of money going out. Few of us realized until the other day that there had been a bill in the U.S. Senate, the Wyden Snow Bill, that would have fined any company 35% if they had not paid back over $100,000 in compensation to their employees if they received the TARP funds. Somehow that bill mysteriously died in committee, and many people put that at the doorstep of Secretary of Treasury Geithner and people in the administration. We'll talk about that and more with the man who kind of was there at the forefront of all this, taking on AIG, and now the country's talking about what Elijah Cummings did in the last few weeks, in the last few months, to mitigate this and to fight against bonuses and to fight for the people's rights. And people are now taking notice. Elijah Cummings, welcome. Good to have you with us. Is Elijah there? Can we pot him up, please?
Hello.
Hey, Elijah. How are you? Elijah?
Yes, I'm right here.
Good, we got you.
I'm here.
Good. So welcome. It's a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
Good to be with you, but I've got some music playing in the background.
All right, well, let's get that music out of there so we don't distract.
There we go.
Good. 410-319-8888. Join us here with Congressman Elijah Cummings. Your thoughts on what's going on in Washington, D.C. It's interesting, Elijah, that today the news is now breaking about how you asked the Financial Services Committee, even though you're on House Oversight, made a special request to question Edward Liddy, the head of AIG. And as I watched you in the video, you quickly dispensed with the idea that Edward Liddy had no idea these bonuses were being given. It was not on his watch, but you clearly uncovered that for all of us.
Yeah, Liddy, oh boy, there's so much to this story.
It's insane.
Yeah,
go ahead.
It's incredible. As a matter of fact, we've got, at the end of our hearing yesterday, and by the way, I don't even sit on financial services.
Right, but you asked for special permission
to interview. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I can tell you, at the end of the hearing, when you get that special permission, you come at the very end of a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, because the members of the committee get first opportunity to ask questions, and so I came in. I was almost the last questioner, but when I did have an opportunity to question Liddy, he admitted that he has approved himself over 4,500 bonuses and retention payments himself. He was claiming that all this happened before him, but that's not true. At first, in the early part of the hearing, so it was an interesting situation.
Well, Congressman Cummings, let me kind of push this further, because I think that there are a lot of pieces to this that America wants to figure out. And part of those pieces are that there was a bill that came out of the U.S. Senate, the Wyden Snow Bill, crossing party lines, that would have not allowed any bonuses over $100,000, penalties of 35% on top of that if you didn't repay it, if you gave bonuses out on top of that, as well as a tax of that amount. Had to be paid to the Treasury. The bill passed the U.S. Senate, went to conference committee between the House and the Senate, and mysteriously died. If that bill had passed, this might not have happened today, A. And B, now they're saying that it is the Secretary of the Treasury Geithner, and others, Summers in the administration, who may have been the ones to kill that bill.
Well, according to Senator Dodd, he claims that he had urging from Geithner and the administration to kill that portion of the conference report, and that's kind of disturbing to me, because it goes against everything that I've been fighting for really all my political life.
Mm-hmm.
The problem, a lot of people have asked the question, why are people so, and why am I so upset about these bonuses? And if you listen to some of the talking heads, Mark, you will hear them say, well, why get upset over a measly little $165 million or maybe $400 some million or maybe even $1 billion when these guys at AIG are dealing with literally hundreds of billions of dollars. And they say, this is small potatoes. I mean, that's how I've heard that over and over
again.
But it's not to the guys on Madison Avenue. Because the guy, I'm talking about Madison Avenue in Baltimore where I live. Because to them, first of all, it goes against every single thing we believe in. We believe that you are rewarded for best effort and rewarded for success in accomplishing something. That's when you go to work. When you go to work, you don't get paid for failure. As a matter of fact, you get fired for failure.
Right.
Here we have folks who literally bought not only the company down, but have helped to bring the country down and, to a large degree, the world.
Well, I mean, but Cosmo Cummings, one of the things that I was reading about is that in 2008, people who run these financial institutions received more than $274 billion from TARP, and they paid out an estimated $18.4 billion in bonuses, almost the same amount they paid out in 2004 when the Dow Jones hit over 10,000. I mean,
right.
So it is billions of dollars. It may not be billions of dollars with AIG, but it is billions of dollars we're talking about here.
And what I'm saying to you, Mark, is that when you think about when you think about folks losing their houses, their savings, you know, their life, their health insurance, and whatever, to see things like this happen is very alarming. And you know, I've met with Mr. Liddy.
Yes.
And Mr. Liddy initially had told me.
Mr. Liddy being the head of AIG.
Yeah, he is the head guy at AIG.
Right.
He told me initially that there were no bonuses. Then he told me that there were 130 retention payments. Then he told me, after I found out a little bit of information, that there were 168 retention payments. Then he told me, after I found out some more information from doing some searching, that there were literally thousands of retention payments. Thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And so Mr. Liddy also told me one of the reasons why I first began talking to him is because we were talking about all these junkets that the employees were going on. And I was trying to figure out how that was when the people of our country were spending so much money on AIG. And he said, yeah, there have been some junkets, but our employees are not really involved in these. And then I found out the employees were attending. They were part of the process. So, I mean, over and over again, I've gotten these stories from Mr. Liddy that have not been complete.
Well, Congressman Cummings, let me just ask this one other thing here. I'm going to open the phones so people join us at 410-319-8888. We're talking with Congressman Elijah Cummings of the 7th District in the first part of our program, talking about AIG and the bonuses paid out to corporate executives and the unsung work, I would say, that, and I'm not trying to blow smoke here, but the unsung work that Congressman Cummings has been doing, taking this on in Congress, and is finally taking the light that he has taken on Edward Liddy of AIG and others to demand some changes. We're going to talk about some of the reasons this is happening, go back to what happened with the Wyden-Snow bill that's going to be reintroduced to Congress. But let me ask this one question. We'll go right to the phones. We have a lot of callers and only about 25 minutes left with you. So it turns out in some research that I was looking at that AIG spent $53,000 a day lobbying Congress every day it was in session last year, a total of $9.7 million. Now, two of the biggest, two of the people who received the most money from AIG were the people who run the committees that govern AIG, Senator Dodd and Senator Baucus. And that other people who are in the administration have received hundreds of thousands of dollars, even the president and the vice president. Now, does this disturb you at all?
It's very disturbing. And the reason why it's disturbing, first of all, let me say this: raising funds is not the easiest thing to do.
No, it's not.
It may be kind of easy for President Obama, but for many, it's very, very difficult. And I've seen some of those figures, and they are pretty high figures that have been given. I think the problem is, Mark, is the public trust. When the public sees those kind of figures, and then they see the type of action that we have here, they begin to lose trust. And a lot of the public is already skeptical. And when they see these kind of things and they see something being pulled from a bill at the last minute, and then they follow the dots, and the dots lead back to substantial campaign contributions, then they just put one and one together and come to their own conclusions. Now, it may not even be about that, but they come to reasonable conclusions. And the conclusions are not favorable to the elected officials, and that's why I really wish we could take money out of the election process, because I think it would help all of us. Because it's not unusual for folks who have difficult races to spend 3, 4, 5 hours a day just trying to raise money.
Right. Let me open the phones here, Congressman, if I might. 410-319-8888. We're talking with Congressman Elijah Cummings about AIG, about the Wyden snow bill that was killed in conference committee that may be coming back up to U.S. Senate that would not allow these bonuses to take place in the first place. And I'll talk a bit more later about what might have killed this and why. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. And let's go to Robert in Hunt Valley. You're on the air.
Hello. Good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, Robert.
Good evening.
My first thought is that there's some fundamentals that are really screwed up with AIG, and it starts at top down. There's a whole performance management criteria that, in order for an organization to reward their employees, there has to be positive results. And the folks that work for them, I'm assuming because of the role they have, that entitle them to 2 bonuses, are mature adults. And the organization I work in locally, we don't do well. There is nothing to give.
Well, one of the things
finish, Robert.
Yeah, you can't cloak things under retention bonuses because the maturity piece comes back in again too. As well, hey, if you're not getting what you need where you are, you have to move on.
Well,
and I can understand wanting to keep the best intellectual and the best professionals in your organization, but if your organization is not doing having positive results, you can't just give away the farm. It's not yours to give.
Okay, Congressman?
Well, you know, first of all...
And thank you very much.
Yeah, excellent question and comment. When I first started talking to Mr. Liddy about these retention payments, he calls them retention payments, and by the way, I spent a lot of time just trying to squeeze out information about these retention payments. He initially said that they were paying them because their agreement with the United States government was that they had to sell parts of their business. And it's sort of like, and he used this analogy with me when I met with him on January the 15th of this year. He said it's like when he gets ready to sell, say, a subsidiary of the company, of AIG, it's like selling the Lakers without Kobe Bryant or Phil Jackson, if those people were to leave.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they have special talents, special skills, and people are basically buying, in large part, the skills that are brought along with whatever that entity might be. Okay, got that. Now, he then changed it to, and then we found, so that, I understood that part. But then we discovered that he was also paying money to people, bonuses, $1 million, I mean, some as much as $6.5 million, to people in the financial products division. Now, the financial products division is that division that has basically brought the company down. So I asked him, I said, well, wait a minute, let me get this straight. I thought you were paying people to keep them. He says, yeah, we're paying them to keep them. And he said this yesterday also, so that they can wound down the business. And, I mean, and this is over a course of maybe of less than a year. And I said, well, wait a minute. You're going to pay only, is it only these people that can wound down the business in that area? And he said that the deals are that complicated and that they have to pay this kind of money to address the issues. In other words, these are the only people that he felt comfortable mm-hmm. could resolve the issue. And I'm talking about millions of dollars.
You raised that with him in the committee hearing.
Right. That's right.
So let me get another call here. 410-319-8888. Elma in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Hi, Elma.
Hi, Elma.
And my retirement fund is in AIG. I'm in a large healthcare group.
Mm-hmm.
The point I wanted to make is that I understood Senator Cummins saying that some people think that these millions of dollars is pennies. To us working people who have our retirement, and I'm 54, pushing 55 now,
mm-hmm.
a household, looking towards my retirement years, I have a problem with bailing people out who are given retention bonuses. And on my job, we're cutting down. We're not allowed to have retention bonuses. They cut that. They cut overtime. They just closed the whole unit because it can no longer bring in enough money to keep it open because the system is so strapped. And I really, you know, to me, that's a lot of money. I would like to have $1 million just for a year's salary. And I don't even make 50 a year.
Alma, let me tell you something. You're the person that I'm speaking for every day. I bring up stories like yours every day. When I talk to Mr. Liddy about people like you, he doesn't even get it. You got to understand. These guys talk about, they talk about $1 million like you talk about $5. I mean, literally. It's like I felt like I was talking to somebody from another planet. Because he has a whole different view of life and a whole different view of money. And I don't know that he has a clue of how the average citizen lives. As a matter of fact, I got the impression, Mark, that in the times that I talked to him,
mm-hmm.
that he just despised me, despised the fact, I mean, he just hated the fact that I would even dare ask him a few questions.
I can see the look on his face.
Yeah.
I saw the look on his face. I have to ask this. Well, let me get another caller in, then I'll ask you another question. 410-319-8888. Elma, thanks so much for your call, and this is why the show is here for people like you, like the rest of us, who are trying to fight to survive in this country and be able to have a decent living in retirement. 410-319-8888. Chris and White Marsh, you're on the air.
Good afternoon.
Hi, Chris.
Good afternoon.
Thanks for taking my call. Before I make my comment and ask my question, Congressman Cummins, I just want to praise you as a true champion for the people, and your record kind of speaks for itself.
Thank you.
With that being said, I think, you know, your last comment really hit the nail on the head. I think just that I just question just the philosophy behind the government that is of the people, for the people, and by the people, how you fit in to a Wall Street culture that bred greed and bonuses in the first place. And I think it's a philosophical question where, you know, I understand where the outrage is, but just like you said, like, that is the culture of the business. And how do you, you know, is it really the government's place to change that culture without moving to a socialist model? Now, I don't think it's their bonuses. Now, I totally agree. But that contract, retention bonuses and things of that nature, if you were to poll the majority of the companies that are receiving TARP, you know, that are eligible for the TARP and just other financial institutions, that's common practice.
So how
do you kind of, you know, and I understand where you're coming from, but isn't this really a case of apples and oranges?
You know, I'm so glad you asked the question, because that's what makes this so difficult, caller. The problem is that we would not, and the president said this, and I feel this way, we would not be having this discussion whatsoever if it were not for the fact that government money is involved in this process. And we would not be having this conversation if these companies like AIG did not come begging you as a taxpayer for your hard-earned tax dollars to stay afloat. And the discussion is a very difficult one, mm-hmm. but we have to interject ourselves into that culture. And you're right. It's a tough conversation. And it's almost like one person speaking French and the other one speaking Chinese. Mm-hmm. But at some point, you know, I think we have to do those things that, like the Congress did today, to say that, okay, we want our money back, to jolt them a little bit, to say, no, it doesn't work that way as long as you're receiving our hard-earned taxpayer dollars. The lady that called a few minutes ago said Elma. Something very profound, too. She was saying that, you know, she wants the bailout. I mean, she said, just give me $1 million. I don't need $1 billion. Just give me $1 million. She probably would have said 50,000. You know, so, but we've got to keep banging on them, because if you don't, these folks will run right over us.
Congressman, this question, Chris, I'm glad you called in and got into the swing of things here. I appreciate you being part of the show. When you look at the fact that the Wyden snow bill that would have stopped this from happening in the first place, would have not allowed the bonuses to take place, was killed in conference committee. There's a lot of speculation, a lot of people saying that Secretary of Treasury Geithner knew about this months ago, even though he's saying he did not, that he was there in February, on February 11th, lobbying at the time the stimulus bill conference was taking place for insertion of language to make sure that AIG and other bonuses were paid in full. That was in February. And there are many people now arguing that Ben Bernanke knew about this, that a number of people Summers knew about this, that many people in the administration knew about this, and that part of the problem is here, and is that much of our president's economic team is from Wall Street,
and they think like
Wall Streeters, and not like other economists and other regular citizens about how this needs to be fixed, and that's the problem, part of the problem.
We have, and I have heard that argument, and there may be some validity to that argument. Sadly, what has happened is that a lot of the people who have the expertise to even deal with these complicated problems are found on Wall Street. And let me tell you where that came from, Mark, a man who I respect tremendously on these issues, and that's the former head of the Federal Reserve, Mr. Volcker. He told another committee that I sit on, the Joint Economic Committee, he said that these deals are so very, very complicated to get the people in place in the Treasury Department is almost impossible. He said, and he gave us the reasons why. He said, first of all, you've got people who are already making a lot of money, okay? So then you got to pull them away from a job where their salary is going to be cut substantially. Then you're asking them to take on one of the most difficult issues that has ever been addressed in the history of our country from an economic standpoint. Then they've got to go through vetting. So that means that they've got to go through, put all of their business out on the street, and we've seen what has happened to some people when they went through the vetting process. And then he said that you got to change your whole life from a private life to a public life. And he said that's a lot. But I can tell you that there are a number of people in the pipeline who have not been finished the vetting process yet, but who are not your typical Wall Street type, but they have had the experiences. And one of the things that a number of us have been urging President Obama to do is to even bring Mr. Volcker in. He has him as one of his advisors, but to bring him in even more so to his inner circle, because he has the reputation for being able to address these kind of issues. He has the image of someone who is very wise and who has seen a lot and can address them, and he does not have any kind of taint. And I'm not saying everybody on Wall Street has a taint, but I'm just basing this on the question you just asked me, so that people would have that trusting feeling. And so I don't know exactly what the president is going to do. I believe that Geithner can do the job, but I know that Geithner is coming under phenomenal fire. And
as he should at the moment, I think.
As he should.
I mean, the problem with the team, it seems, look back at the phones, you only have a couple minutes left, but the team, as you were just pointing out, is not balanced. It's not balanced between other economic thinkers other than Wall Street thinkers,
right.
And that's a problem.
That is a major problem.
410-319-8888. Very quick comment. We don't have a great deal of time left for this segment of our show. And Kevin, you're on the air. A very quick comment.
Yes. Good afternoon, Congressman Cummings.
How are you? Hi, Kevin.
Kevin, we have a very short amount of time. We have to get right to the point. I'm sorry.
My question is, if right now Mr. Cummings is the one that's doing this, how many other companies are out there doing the same thing that the public is not aware of or the media is not aware of and could be possibly doing the same thing and getting away with it?
I think there may be quite a few. As you probably heard, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac yesterday announced the story came out about their bonuses. So there are probably quite a few, but I can tell you we are about to get to the bottom of a whole lot of this. Okay? Just stay tuned.
Let's try another quick call here, 410-319-8888. Russ, a very quick comment. We have less than 2 minutes for a break.
Greetings, Mark, to you and the congressman. My issue is that Congress play as large a role in letting this happen as anybody else, because I thought that the repeal of Glass-Steagall was a humongous mistake. And secondly, in 2000, if I'm researching this now, that Congress passed a law that allowed AIG and other insurance companies to get into the banking and securities and all the other things that they were by law, by Glass-Steagall, prevented from doing.
That's right.
So what would we expect to happen when you tear down all of the walls that separated
us? And that's what a number of us have been saying. That was deregulating, and we've got to get back to regulating, because there's been an abuse of the process, and that's part of the reason why we are where we are today.
Russ, thank you so much for your call. Do we have time for the caller? Congressman, I want to thank you so much for being here. We'll come back to this in the coming weeks and appreciate you being on Capitol Hill to fight the good fight, and we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you. Thank all of you for calling in here. We're going to continue looking at this. This is something that is one of the most important things we have to face, and we're not going to let it go here on the Mark Steiner Show, and I appreciate all of you calling in. Sorry I couldn't get to more callers. We only had the congressman for a half an hour today, but we will come back to him and others in the coming weeks. We're going to take a very short break now, and when we come back from that break, we're going to bring you some interesting conversations from the Urbanite magazine. Remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still there to help people during difficult times. More information is available at mecu.com. And we're also made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. More information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us for interesting conversations that you weren't expecting. I'm Mark Steiner. For the past 3 years, Urbanite magazine has embarked on a curious project of innovative collaboration. What would happen, they ask, if you took two smart and creative people from different backgrounds, pair them up, and invite them to collaborate on whatever they wanted? What interesting ideas and innovations would be sparked? In the March issue of Urbanite, 5 teams were paired up for the 3rd year of the project, and today we're talking with 2 of those teams. I'll begin with team number 3, which included Drew Schmidt-Perkins, the executive director of 1,000 Friends of Maryland, who spent the past 28 years working on energy, growth, and environmental issues. Her partner was Catherine Pancake, a local artist and filmmaker, whose documentary Black Diamonds explored the tragedy of mountaintop removal when mining for coal in Appalachia. They developed the Be More Productive Baltimore Neighborhood Diagnostic Tool. They sat down with me to explore how they came to collaborate on this project and what it means for all of us.
It's somewhat of a mystery how we get selected. The Urbanite has
You didn't select each other? You were selected?
No, no. The Urbanite collects a pool of people who are ridiculous enough to say, sure, that sounds like a great idea to do during your most busy period of your lives. and then they, through some equally mysterious way, pair you up with somebody who is different. So I'm a, you know, environmental policy person. Catherine's an artist and filmmaker. So they paired us.
There's not that deep a gulf, Catherine. You're deeply involved in environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of your work.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty clear right away that there was a clear overlap around, you know, both of us had done a lot of work with communities and helping communities identify what's special or innately good or productive about them, and how those communities have come into conflict with things from the outside that maybe haven't been so good for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we started thinking about and talking about what could neighborhoods in Baltimore do to take a bit more control or be a bit more proactive in being more productive and generating more of their own energy or more of their own food in order to just be more self-sufficient and more self-aware in lieu of just absorbing development or feeling left out of development. So that was sort of where we felt we overlapped, because we both had a lot of experience of watching communities deal with outside forces and how to negotiate that.
Right. Well, you both
on
have.
Many different levels. So.
Right. I mean,
and seeing the pain that you know results when the community feels put upon or feels like they're being destroyed or whatever, and also how government entities and developers also get kind of left out or not, you know, feeling good about those situations. So that was kind of where we started, and then we had to kind of boil it like really way down for the magazine.
So tell me, what did you do? I mean, tell us about what this meant, what you came up with, and exactly how that fit in. I mean, on the page they have this story here about the neighborhood diagnostic tool, which is what you created, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there are four pieces to it, at least on that we see in the article: solar, bees, weeds, and food. So, uh-huh. I mean, what neighborhood did you pick? How did you get into it? And what do these four things mean?
We did go through Catherine's neighborhood of Seton Hill. I think our goal was to have people step back and look at their own neighborhood differently and see different resources that were there. And so the two ones that we highlighted were micro farming, if you will, the ability to produce little bits of food or even significant amount of food in small plots of land, sort of part of the whole local foods, safer foods and saving money kind of concept. And then the other immediate resource that Catherine pointed out was just the ability for this area to use more solar.
Mm-hmm.
We have extensive acres of rooftops which are sitting up there unused but could be harvested for energy production. And it is this resource that we just don't think about. So that was sort of our concept, was really to look differently at the spaces. And then that brought in the whole issue of weeds. Weeds are not all bad. Weeds have a bad reputation, but they're actually doing many good things, and many of them are actually beneficial. And then both of us like bees.
Mm-hmm.
And so we turned out both to have this bee thing.
How did it play itself out in reality as you worked on this thing?
Well, what was really interesting is, I mean, we generated kind of a long list of possibilities and we boiled it down to these four that we liked. So we set up a tour of Seton Hill, the Seton Hill neighborhood, which
over
is
on the west side of Baltimore.
West side of Baltimore, which is my neighborhood, which is a really interesting neighborhood because it's a mixed neighborhood.
Racially and by class.
Racially and by class and by sexual orientation. There's a housing project. There's sort of a historical neighborhood. There's more kind of upper class, you know, on the other side of St. Mary's Park. So it's kind of an interesting, and it has its problems. There was recently some violence there. But we did a walkthrough with Karen French, who's amazing, who works at the Walters, and she's the head of the community association. And it was really interesting because they had thought of a lot of these things already, and they had talked about them, and they talked about some of the barriers that they had to farming and gardening in terms of how to do that and what was appropriate. We talked about solar and we talked about some of the barriers that could be possible with historical neighborhoods because some of them have a lot of rules on what you can do with historical buildings. So it brought up some of those more practical issues. But also immediately people were excited about it and wanted to identify and were really happy to identify what areas would be possible. Would solar work on my house? How does that happen? A lot of people know about these things, but the actual practical realities of implementing them are still kind of a mystery. So it was good to kind of really bring that together.
It was a frigid day.
Yeah,
I mean, it was like, I don't know, 20 degrees. It was really maybe even colder.
Good day
freezing.
For a walk around
right.
But we kept picking up neighbors along the way.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we were hearing, especially for some of the older neighbors who had been part of this community for multiple generations, were that there used to be a whole lot more farming in their neighborhood, if you will. There were the backyard plots. There
right.
was the talk of growing the beans up the back fence. There
right.
was the sort of something that we've gotten
away
really
from.
Away from.
Yep.
And that this is sort of a way back to older habits and traditions. Now, the solar is sort of the other side, but we used to use, you know, in that same time period, wind and solar differently. I mean, we kept our shades up. We didn't, you know, windows up. We, you know, dried our clothes outside. All those kinds of things were part of it. So in some ways, it became apparent that we were stepping back in a modern way.
Mm-hmm. Because in some ways, when you think about sustainability,
mm-hmm.
it's both moving forward and stepping back.
Right.
It's the marriage of the two, of tradition and futuristic worlds. And let me walk through very quickly these four things. I'd like you to, let's continue this game that you started the other night.
Okay.
And let's play it out. So what would it mean? Let's just take each one of those four things very quickly. And in your own world of fantasy and reality, what they might mean if you could play it out.
Okay.
All right? So weeds.
Weeds. I think the thing with weeds is that there's a lot of green spaces in the city, weed-filled lots, weeds in the backyard, spaces that are considered kind of detritus or marginalized that could be left as green space or valued as green space somehow tended. They, you know, process a lot of carbon dioxide. They're good for maintaining the soil erosion. There's also the possibility of using them for greens and using them for salads, lamb's quarters and dandelion greens. And if you talk to people who are into herbal medicine or botanicals, there are different weeds and herbs that can be used for medicinal purposes. But also the weeds that grow in cities many times, like dandelion greens are good for, they're kind of antioxidants. So they grow mm-hmm. in toxic environments. Mm-hmm. They process toxics really well. I mean, there's a lot of fear I know in my neighborhood and even with gardening. What's in the soil? Am I going to get sick? I mean, there are a lot of concerns around
right.
using, you know,
right.
Flora that's in the city. But we wanted to just talk about that in terms of whatever's in your backyard or whatever's around in the gardens, kind of not necessarily just seeing it as something to destroy or pave over or get rid of, but to kind of look at it as a green space. So,
and food.
Food, again, you know, sort of harkening back to we used to produce more of our food, even if it was just in a couple pots on the, you know, the backyard or the beans running up against the backyard fence. But in this time of agribusiness and high price of food and the lack of fresh fruits and vegetables in our neighborhoods, what does it mean if we start, again, looking at space differently and look to produce food? Now, my original thought on the food thing was to actually... And with the solar, was trying to figure out how much food could Baltimore produce, how much solar could produce. Now, some of the data that we came across along the way is to feed a family, I guess it's your typical family of four, you need about 4,000 square feet of gardening. And that could produce all the food a family
needs. One family.
So then I start to look at my little plots that I grow vegetables for my family and how much food I produce. And it becomes clear that I can quickly overproduce lettuce and Swiss chard and tomatoes and zucchinis more than I can feed for my family, or maybe want to. Maybe that's all we ate. We need it all. But and so it became clear that just a little bit of land can produce an awful lot of food, and that we could again begin to look at little spaces differently. You don't need a lot of space to really make a difference in what kind of food you're eating. And this spans from, you know, communities that really are struggling to get fresh food into their neighborhoods, the little local church with the little side lot, the places that have decorative plantings could become edible plantings instead. There's, you know, little changes, shifts, but it also is useful in all sorts of neighborhoods. And that was really important. We didn't want to have another article about Baltimore that showed it just as a weed, trash-filled, beleaguered place, but actually this place that has so much to offer and can offer even more. I mean, it was really important that this looked across all of Baltimore and even out into the counties, that this wasn't just, mm-hmm. you know, a right. Baltimore gritty
right,
focus. Yeah.
And solar?
With solar, all of the rooftops. I think if you have less than 6 hours of shade a day, your building could be appropriate for solar. So especially with the row house culture and, you know, just, you know, if you're on a, you know, a high point in Baltimore and you look down, you see all this flat roofs for miles and miles. And it just looks like, you know, just a really untapped resource that we haven't thought about. So the whole idea was sort of look up, you know, look up, think about the rooftops. And so that was kind of the idea with solar. And then, I mean, the barrier with solar many times is cost. The initial financial investment to get solar is pretty prohibitive for a lot of people right now. So that is definitely something that could be for the future. I know there was just a lot of money released, I think yesterday, grant money for doing sustainable housing and conservation. So I think that's really a vision for the future, but I think it's going to be really necessary. And I think when the funding's possible, that's definitely something Baltimore should look at. And also neighborhoods can kind of band together if they have a strong association and look at, you know, how to get panels for the neighborhood itself to push back a little bit on the grid, but just ways of thinking about what resources do we have in the neighborhood.
Did you all think that if this was actually done in a larger way that we could become self-sustainable in energy in our cities and for our homes?
Again, those were sort of hopes that we could do some of these calculations, but Maryland doesn't have any large commercial solar happening. I mean, it's just completely odd.
Though he's now, one of the biggest solar plants in the world here in Frederick.
Right, exactly.
So one of the other, you know, things is they keep talking, and I've run across people who want to take over land, ag land, preserved ag land for wind and solar arrays. So why are we taking over prime ag or looking to places like that when instead we have acres and acres and acres, thousands upon thousands of acres of rooftops that are already paved over already and are, oh, by the way, where people are using the energy. So, you know, whether it's an industrial roof or whether it's a commercial roof or whether it's banding together, you know, a whole block of individuals, we could actually do widespread, huge quantity commercial. And once you start doing that, the costs go down. And this kind of innovative project also then becomes more eligible for federal grants. The federal stimulus money that's coming through has huge amounts of money for energy efficiency and weatherization, all those other important things. So, you know, this is the kind of idea that we just, again, we wanted out of this project to spark a different way to look at things without necessarily having to make follow through. We want somebody else to grasp this idea. You out there, grasp this idea, run with it, and we'll cheer you all the way.
and bees.
Bees. Well, it's interesting because I've been interested in bees for a long time because of the, you know, this whole crisis where the bees are dying off.
Right.
And a lot of people feel that's because of kind of the industrial way that bees are being treated now and the way that they're carted around. And kind of they're not, there's just a ton of fragmentation and death in a lot of the hive community. So I got interested in, you know, and you can buy the bees and you can set them all up and you can do it yourself. I mean, there's definitely like specific ways you have to go about it and resources that you have to have. Like you have to have accessible water. You have to be within a mile of some kind of flora. And you also, the bees travel, the flight path of the bees should not be, you know, on a playground or in the street because they take a very, you know, specific flight path every day to do the pollination. But it's also just an idea, like with the solar, to say, hey, we don't need to just have bees in the county or in agricultural communities. We can have them actually downtown. You can have them in your backyard. You just have to think it through and do it appropriately. And again, you know, it's not that much of an initial investment, and that's selling honey and selling beeswax is a viable way to bring in that extra money. And it may not be something you can do as a full-time job, but it can provide that extra, you know, money that you might need, you know, certain times of the year. So
I love all these ideas, and I think that this is one of the great issues of the Urbanite and the Urbanite Project 2009. It's the March 2009 issue we're talking about. We've been talking to Drew Schmidt Perkins and Catherine Pancake, two activists in our community. Drew Schmidt Perkins, of course, the director of the 1,000 Friends of Maryland, has been fighting for our environment for a long, 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 long time.
Thank you.
Really, you know, it's good.
For very long.
Not that long.
A million years.
Feels like a long time, doesn't it? And Catherine Pancake, who's just an amazing artist and documentary filmmaker, whose 2006 documentary, Black Diamonds, took on flat mountaintop removal in West Virginia, which is where she's from. And they came together to do Be More Productive Baltimore for Urbanite magazine. And you can go to urbaniteBaltimore.com and go to /project/teams/team3 to see what their neighborhood diagnostic tool is all about, or just go to our website, steinershow.org, and find it for yourself there. And I think this is just an amazing project. We should look at this and really think about how different our lives could be if we just push our government and push ourselves in ways we don't think about to be more creative about our future. And thank you for bringing it to all of us. This has been great to see both of you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good. That's awesome.
Thank you. After my conversation with Drew and Catherine, I sat down with another team in the Urbanite Project. I was joined by Luis Flores, an artist and educator who teaches mixed media, sculpture, and design at the Baltimore School for the Arts. His partner was Samuel Gerald Collins, who teaches cultural anthropology at Towson University, specializing in globalization and information society, studying both the U.S. and South Korea. Let me begin by describing their two-page layout in this month's Urbanite. It's called The Game. On the first page is a scattering of objects, a shell, a folded lottery ticket, what looks like a mahjong tile, a small bundle of sticks, a porcelain skull, a tiny book, and more. Arranged seemingly randomly around these images are words like make, identify, assemble, walk, hum, and more. On the next page is a lot of text, including some that's printed backwards. What does it all mean? Rather than explain, Sam and Luis invited me to play.
Well, maybe we should invite Mark to first to lift the page.
Lift the page?
And
turn it, you mean?
No, just lift it up.
Lift it up?
Just by itself and hold it up to the window over there.
Okay, I'm holding it up to the window.
Okay, now you can see right in the middle of the page.
Oh, yes.
Suddenly, an inset of print has become visible.
Wow, if you hold this up to the light, it says, the items on this page form part of a game that has no rules. By examining this game carefully, you have become a player. You may play alone, with a partner, or group. Play as long as you like, then pass the page along. Or better yet, place a dozen found items in a small box with your instructions. Give the game to a friend or a stranger and leave it in a place where someone will find it at a later date. One dozen boxes are already in circulation over the city. So what is this game?
Well, initially,
Luis Flores,
as we were kicking around ideas what this collaboration might be, we soon found that we were very similar in terms of sense of humor and playfulness. Over lunch, we started playing an informal game, passing ideas back and forth. Eventually, that led to emailing and telephone calls. And at some point, Sam said, language, written communication, spoken word over the phone is not enough. I need more to, you know, move this thing forward. And I took that as a cue to act the way I normally do, is to play with objects in my mm-hmm. studio. So I mailed him a small box with a dozen small items and a brief message. And he received that, and I guess the game began with that simple gesture.
That was it was a great box, great objects, coin, belt buckle, interesting curved piece of metal. There was just great stuff, very evocative. And I had students who came to my office to seek my advice. Part of the payback was they had to arrange the objects in some way.
They're obviously in this box.
Yeah, and I took pictures of it and sent them back to Luis. So that was my turn in the game. But that was what we decided that we would do. Here we had undertaken a kind of game, and we wanted to share what we've done with other people and try to invite them to join.
What do you mean that people rearrange things in the box? What did that to say? What? What was the box saying to them, and what were they saying to the objects in the box? What was?
Well, I didn't want them to tell me, frankly.
What about for yourself?
For me, the box was some insight into Louise a little bit. Some of the things I thought spoke to his personal history, but a lot of them were just sort of, I think, aesthetically interesting. So he had, at some point, found them and picked them up and saved them. But when my students arranged them, that was their part of the game. I didn't want to ask them to interpret that, or even worse, I didn't want to prefer some master interpretation of what they'd done.
At one of those early lunches, over a lot of laughter. One of the things that came up early on, you know, this idea of game that has no rules. Anybody that plays wins. And you determine the length of time that you stay engaged with the objects or language. We soon realized that, you know, this was about communication and inviting people to communicate, slow down, take the time to look at things, ordinary things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's all around us anyway. You know, why not use that in some form to engage or reconnect with others, even strangers for that matter, in ways that we normally don't do on a day-to-day basis.
So the picture in the magazine, the game, this was not your box. Was this your box, Luis?
Some of them are. Most of them are not. In fact, at some point we decided that if we were going to use objects or language in the way of list or trigger words, that we would each contribute 50-50. So, it's, you know, I don't know why we arrived at a dozen, but Sam contributed six objects and six words. I made two lists and went with the first list because it seemed like they were simple words. All of them were monosyllabic, and they spoke to me of communicating with young people, preschoolers even.
And each word had to do with was associated with an object you put in the box?
No.
No.
No. There were random. The list was made independent in my list making. It was made independent of my choice of objects.
So the connection between the objects and the words were?
I think the words, from my perspective, are an invitation for people to assemble objects in their mind and also physically.
So when you do this, I'm curious. Take this little game. I mean, so you send these objects to you. Luis Flores sends objects to Samuel Collins, right?
Mm.
So can you remember what was in the box and what you did with them and why you did it the way you did?
Luis sends me the objects. I have students arrange them, and I ended up adding a few objects. So for some reason, I lost a couple of the objects in the box, so I added a few more objects, and I ended up giving the box away with a lot of fanfare at another conference I was at over at Towson. And the box, hopefully, is winging its way somewhere else right now.
And so when you have these boxes across the city, what are your thoughts about what you think this game will do? I mean, is there an object in your minds about what this game should or would do?
My hope is that, you know, whoever, you know, picks up a box, or in the case of the page, if the game playing only consists of manipulating
that.
The page,
right.
And that's it, that they might think about how they generally receive information in print,
right.
Whether it's pictures or words, how they process that, how they use it, and maybe pass it along, even if it's in a casual conversation at dinner time. You know, curious thing happened to me on the way to work this morning. I saw this box sitting in a seat next to me, and I picked it up, and it had these little instructions and some objects in it. And here it is.
There it is.
Do you want to play?
So I wonder if they found these boxes around the city.
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can only think that, imagine someone's relief when they open the box and realize that it's just a box full of interesting objects and not something much more dangerous.
Right.
So if anybody's listening to this and you find the box, you have to continue the game. You move you put something in the box, your own messages, your own objects,
certainly.
And put it somewhere else in the city, or leave it on a doorstep or on a windowsill or on a bench or wherever that may be.
Anywhere, or make your own box.
Or make your own box.
And that can be, as Luis was saying, that can be a metaphorical box, like the box of this page, or it can be something more physical.
I like this.
And the thing that really fascinates me is that it's all-inclusive. It doesn't have to be with people you know.
We had hoped that, actually,
right.
The people who don't know each other might initiate something, and not necessarily a friendship or a dialogue, but even just a connection of some sort.
Sure.
I like this.
I found this on the seat next to you. Is this yours? No. You know, what's in it? Oh, look. You know, and then they begin this conversation. Wonder what it's for. There's a note here. Mm-hmm. They read the note and something happens.
And you can help something happen by picking up a copy of this month's Urbanite to learn more about the game, created by Sam Collins and Luis Flores. They collaborated as part of Urbanite's third annual Urbanite project, their yearly exploration in innovative collaboration. We've had a blast bringing you this month's Urbanite stories to Radio Life, and we'll do the same the next month for the Urbanite Green Issue, so stay tuned. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justine Levy. We're engineered at WEAA by Zachary Coleman, and hear Clean Cuts by Liz Buckle and Nick Sostrom. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again or to podcast any of our future shows, please visit our website, steinershow.org. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.